Hi, this is Randy Brewer, and over the next hour, I'll be your host for a profile of Mr. Brady Blade, renowned musician, entrepreneur, and co-owner of Blade Studios here in Shreveport. We'll talk about his life, his music career, and the current work he is doing with Blade Studios. Mr. Blade has been the producer and manager of numerous bands over the past several decades and served as the A&R man for several record labels before joining in 1995 with Emmylou Harris as the drummer for her band Spy Boy, along with the famed record producer and guitarist Daniel Lanois and bassist Daryl Johnson. Soon he found himself expanding his role as an in-demand session and touring drummer for artists like Steve Earle, Jewel, and the Indigo Girls, which eventually led him to become a key part of the Dave Matthews Jam Band project, Dave Matthews and Friends, with whom he recorded and toured extensively. He has worked with artists ranging from Bob Dylan and Patti Griffin to Buddy and Julie Miller, Eric Bibb, Daniel Lanois, and Solomon Burke. He is well known as a record producer, and his extensive discography includes film work, writing and composing, and nurturing talent across the globe. He returned to his home in Shreveport after living in Sweden for many years to open Blade Studios. Brady sat down with me for a brief look back at his life and career, and later this hour he'll share with us some tracks from some of the artists he's worked with over the years. Well, it's really a pleasure and an honor to speak with Mr. Brady Blade today, a Shreveport native. We're here in Blade Studios, and Mr. Blade's an accomplished drummer and really world traveler, prolific musician, businessman. We really appreciate you agreeing to do the interview today.
Thank you so much. I'm glad to be here.
So Shreveport's really your hometown.
My hometown. Born at Shumpert Hospital and grew up in Stoner Hill on Holly Street, you know, right by Centenary College. So yeah, this is home. And I'm glad to be back after being gone for so long.
So the idea of the studio brought you back to Shreveport.
Actually, the mayor's office, I think it was 2007, and Mayor Glover is a dear friend, and he became, you know, the first black mayor for the city. And we went to high school together at Caddo Magnet. And I had worked for the government. After I finished Centenary, I worked for the federal government, Housing and Urban Development. So I did work in, you know, government before. However, that position was a bit mundane for a young man. And after a year and a few months, I went back to the creative side of life. But the mayor knew this, and he called and said it might be a position opening up in economic development that would cater more to the artistic and creative side of economic development for our city. I had just, I had a young child. I wasn't really touring anymore as I was before, and I was in Stockholm, Sweden. And the opportunity to do that felt really attractive in many senses because I felt I was getting a bit older, and to be honest, great playing with rock stars and touring around and stuff, but after you get a family, you start to reevaluate your, you know, your expectations about life. So I talked to my wife about it, and the position was offered, and I accepted it. It was very challenging, very fun to work in city government. I didn't realize the amount of hours I would have to put into this. But at the same time, I saw a void in the city as far as the kind of company that Blade Studios is. I saw that did not exist actually in the whole state of Louisiana. So my second child was on the way. My wife was in Sweden. So I resigned from the mayor's office and went back to Europe, and always had in the back of my mind, hopefully I can return home one day. My father, Bill Blade Sr., has been a pastor at Zion Baptist Church for 50 years this year. Got very ill to the point where it was a 50-50 chance he would live or not. That woke me up.
Yeah, absolutely.
At the same time, I had a opportunity to go to England to a cushy position. I'm going to move the family to London or come here and try to start a company in the worst economic climate that existed in the civilized world. I took the, so to speak, hard road because family is everything. I came back to Shreveport really for my mother and father, who are in their 70s now, and I thought it was important that they know their international Swedish grandkids, and you know, and my wife followed me in that dream. It was a tough road. And actually, I don't regret one minute of it. You know, we put in a lot of work, a lot of effort to get this done here. And I think we're pleased with the results.
Well, you bring back a lot of life experience and really world cultural experience back to Shreveport.
Yeah, my wife, and she moved her company here. She's Swedish, and with the chairman of Blade Studios is from France. So yeah, it's a little international organization we have going on here.
That's cool. That's what we need. You know, when we were talking earlier, you said, you know, Caddo Magnet High changed my life. You know, and I know Dorsey Summerfield. I know he was there and maybe influenced some of your upbringing there. And
undoubtedly. I mean, if it wasn't for him, my brother and I, you know, as young people in the city, Dorsey really took us under his wing.
Blade.
Yeah. Fantastic drummer and composer, pianist, guitarist. I mean, he's a pretty well-rounded guy. But Dorsey really caught us at a very pivotal point in our lives, because we could have gone on to other schools or whatever, but he not only put us in Magnet High School, or helped us directing our attention toward it. Our grades were always pretty decent, so that wasn't an issue. So not only did he put us in school, but he put us in his working band at night as well. So I was like 14, 15 years old, playing with Dorsey on the weekends, you know, a professional gig, getting paid to do it. Was the most experience, you know, the best experience anyone could possibly have. You know, he's still my mentor. I mean, he comes by here, harasses me sometimes. Yeah, drop, give me 50. I mean, he's still like a really tough force in our life. But I'm thankful for him and always think about him, you know.
Anytime I have the opportunity to listen to him play the sax, you know, it's just a magical experience.
He's great.
Plays around town.
I played a gig with him last month, funny enough. Called me, you know, drummer didn't make it or something. And if I have the time, I'll always do it, you know.
Yeah, so you went down to New Orleans, right?
Yeah, New Orleans, I went to college the first time around. I lived there. And the second time I lived there, I was touring with Emmylou Harris. So I didn't work in the city, but I owned a residence there. So I'd basically get off the road, I might would be there 2 weeks, and I would just kind of write and paint, eat, walk around. It was a great, great time to be there and absorb a lot of the music and things and people that were there. So I still travel there quite a bit. We just had Galactic here in the studio, actually, you know, Stant Moore and those guys. So that was fantastic to have them. This is a very small state, you know. This is a very small country to me. I don't know if it's because I've been bouncing around the world for a long time, but, you know, Baton Rouge, New Orleans, Shreveport, it's all like one place to me in my mind.
And in terms of the road of getting into professional music, I understand you may have been kidnapped when you were at Dillard University somewhat.
I was at Dillard University, and this band called the Killer Bees.
Yeah,
reggae band. They were fantastic, and I used to go see the show sometimes. And you know, I was actually went to see them at a show in New Orleans, and something happened with the drummer, quit, or I don't know, got another gig, and they had some more shows, so they actually came by my dorm room, and it was Malcolm Wellborn, who is now known as Papa Molly in Seven Walkers with Bill Kurtzman from the Grateful Dead and stuff. So they come to my dorm room, I'm like looking at these guys like, okay, what's up? It's like, well, we need you to, you know, to come on the road with us. And I think I just finished finals in my sophomore year. I was about to go home, whatever, for the holidays. And I'm like, okay. So I joined the reggae band. I packed up my stuff and joined the band, called my dad from the first gig. He was furious. My mom wanted to kill me as well. But we went to Trinidad, we played in Jamaica, played every club and almost in North America. I mean, we were constantly on the road for that year and 4 months. So it was a great experience. And then I stopped and I went back to school at Centenary and graduated in business, but it was a good time.
And then you met Emmylou.
Yeah, that Emmylou story is, I guess to make a long story short, I was managing a band called the Brand New Heavies, and we had a club date to play in San Diego. I think we're in Los Angeles mixing the second record, Brother Sister. And the boys in the band, it was three boys and a girl. The three boys went to Mexico. One of the boys got in a little bit of trouble. Now, the show was the very next day in San Diego. We were based in L.A. at the time. So I had to put a band together behind the girl singer in one day. So I called Mike Boydo, Xander Schlott, who pretty much famous for the Circle Jerks. He was in Sid and Nancy, you know, Alex Cox film, you know, cool guy. I think I had Arif Marshall, who was a Chili Pepper for a minute after one of those guys left or something on guitar. I needed another guitar player, and that guy was Gang Lenoir. And I was dating this really beautiful girl at the time, and she had a cousin named Cindy. So Dan Lenoir, I called Dan, we got this gig in San Diego tomorrow. You know, can you come down and do it? You know, and it's like, well, I'll tell you what, if you get me a date with Cindy, you know, I'll see what I can do. Of course, I made it happen. I called the girl I was dating. Call your cousin. She's got a date tomorrow night. He picked her up, came down, and we basically had an unscripted show. I mean, it was no rehearsal. We didn't have time. So we just set up, but we played like 2.5 hours straight. Now, mind you, I hadn't played drums in years at this point and wasn't a drummer in my mind, but I was playing drums that night. So fast forward a year and a half later, Dan had done the Wrecking Ball album for Emmylou Harris, and which was groundbreaking for her. My brother was on was the drummer on that record, and Larry Mullins Jr. from U2. They finished the record, and then my brother couldn't tour, and I was about to go back to graduate school because eventually I wanted to become a doctor of economics. I wanted to be a teacher. So I was, you know, going to go back to graduate school and then get my doctorate. So Amy called and said, Brady, you know, I've got a couple of shows, you know, to start off the launch of this new record in Boulder, and I was hoping you'd come out. I'm like, well, Miss Harris, no offense, but I think you got the wrong brother. I, you know, don't even own a drum set, literally. I didn't have a kit. She's like, well, wow, you know, Dan said he has complete confidence in you, and your brother recommended you highly. I'm like, well, you know, I don't think it's, you know, I appreciate it, but she's like, just come out for a couple of days, see how it goes. Yes, ma'am. Flew out there for 2 days to Boulder, and 3 days, because we rehearsed one day and then the radio show the next 2 days. Ended up being with Emmylou Harris 9 years. So it's funny how things can change in your life that are completely unexpected. You know, it completely shifted everything I thought I was going to do.
So she became your mentor and
in a big
got
way.
Somewhat connected at that point.
We're dear friends to this day. She took care of me like I was her son, basically. Spy Boy, I think, was the most rowdiest band she's ever had. You know, they had the Hot Band, and she always worked with all these stars, but that band was pretty groundbreaking and innovative. Daryl Johnson was on bass, Daniel Lenoir, myself, and Emmy, four-piece band. Loud and rowdy, hitting the road worldwide. And then Buddy Miller joined the band a year after Daniel had been in the band, and that was a whole nother chapter in my life. Buddy's now producer for Robert Plant and all this other stuff, and we still record quite a bit together. So yeah, she changed my life. And because of her, I got to meet a lot of people, got exposed to a lot of scenarios and situations that normally, you know, you wouldn't be in. And she's just such a sweet, sweet, beautiful lady.
So I remember another part of the story. You were at some point, I believe, working with a band in London. Turned out that you started a company.
Absolutely correct. I was friends with the singer. I was working in Los Angeles at the time at Island Records. And then the girl was having some problems with this new band she had joined as far as like getting paid and all this other stuff. And she's like, can you come to London and help me out? And I was like, well, get your lawyer to do it or, you know, somebody. She's like, yeah, but they have no jurisdiction in England, so I need somebody as a manager or something to kind of sort me out. But I'm like, I'm not a manager, but I'll see what I can do. Flew to London with a couple of friends just to kind of make a fun time out of it as well. But it worked out. I got her money arranged, and I decided to stay like an extra week. And in that week's time, the three boys that were in the band as well said, okay, can you manage us? And I'm looking at all of them like, I'm not a manager. I don't know how to manage a band. I was 22, something like that. But they believed in me, so I started Blade Management. Now,
so this is before you went on the road with Emmylou Harris?
That was before, yeah, because at that time I wasn't playing drums. I was working at a record label, and then I embarked on this management company, which lasted 4 years, and yeah, made a grave mistake by not taking a vacation. The company grew very fast, sold it for a profit, thank goodness. Had a few gold and platinum records during the course of the time. had a remix team that I was working with called Blacksmith. And those guys now are actually doing stuff like Beyonce and all these other big people. You know, we're all young at the time in London. But guys like Jamiroquai would, you know, be around the office, who went on to be a star. Kate Moss, the supermodel, interned at the office for a while. So it was a really good time to be in London in the early 90s, mid-90s. But you learn things about yourself when you get in those kind of situations, you know. But it was great. Met a lot of people that I'm still friends with to this day on the other side of business, you know, of music business. So, yeah.
So business and then out in the touring world and kind of back into the business mode now, huh?
Back into the business mode, running a commercial studio in Shreveport, Louisiana, my hometown. I mean, so far we've had some great people come in here. Daryl Jones, who plays bass with the Rolling Stones, used to play with Miles Davis, Sting. We're getting a lot of actors in doing ADR sessions for the movie industry. And we plan to expand out to content as far as working in local development of TV shows, possibly investing in film, definitely doing the soundtracks for film. We scored one video game called Fallen Shadows 2, which was fantastic. Looks like we're doing the third installment, which the game's doing well. So yeah, we're making a little footprint in this business, but we're finding out that, you know, around this country at least, and actually in the world, because we've had a Swedish band in, came all the way from Stockholm, Sweden. A lot of studios in Stockholm, but they came to Shreveport to record their record, which is great.
Nice.
So we're trying to do something.
I think you have a little bit of a selection of some tracks that were recorded here in the studios.
Yeah, I mean, I'm hoping that the audience will like those songs and stuff by some of the local artists. And, you know, it was fun, always fun working with, you know, some of these celebrities that I've worked with, I suppose. But the development of people in our local city, the younger talent especially, is something of great interest to our company. And if we can provide our part of expertise to that scenario, it's a wonderful thing. And to see them come in the studio and learn how to be in the studio and to get results out of it. Yeah, it's a mission and that we enjoy.
So a local singer, Maggie, I believe you played the drums for her here in the studio, right?
Yeah, I produced her debut album. Maggie Kerner is her name. And I think she just actually co-wrote a song for the new Galactic album. So I'm watching this young woman come into her own. And this is pretty much her first time in a studio like this. She's done some small recordings in a couple of places, but to do a whole collection of songs with, you know, a whole staff of people, musicians, engineers, and video technicians, that it was something that was very new to her, but she did very well with it.
Hello. Nice to meet you. I think I like your smile. Hello, it's nice to see you. Cause it's been quite a while. First time, and I can smell that rain. Hello, I see something different. It's nice to be wrong every once in a while. Hello. Okay, I'll change the subject, but please don't ask me to remove this smile. And I think I the first time. And I can smell that rain. And there's no way I feel so damn smitten. If I find this peculiar, I seem to remember drawing a line, and I think I see clover for the first.
Do you see the studio as bringing local talent into the mainstream?
Without a doubt. We're actually in negotiations now to, we have a small record label, and what we need to do for that record label to come to light is they have a distribution partner. So we're in negotiations now with a couple of companies that will allow us not only to be able to record the project here, but be able to have a place where we can distribute it, sell it, so to speak, a pipeline. And once that's in place, we'll be a full-service kind of company where we can work with a young artist. And if we think they have something that takes invest time, maybe even capital into the project, and then hopefully see them do very well. We just co-promoted the Scream tour. That is actually fantastic. And we had a competition for Scream Star. And we had a couple of young people that came in here that literally just blew my socks off. I was so happy. So once those people come into our doors, what can we do for them? And so, and that's what we're addressing now as a company, small as we may be, but we can't leave talented young people out in the wilderness. That's our mission, to try to make it work. So if we can't do anything, at least we can refer them to somebody else that can assist them. So
absolutely, make those connections happen.
Yeah, and that's what we are, a conduit for some of these people, because my brother and I had to leave the city because we had to go where the people were that were doing what we were doing. But now, I think these youth have an opportunity between Blade Studios, Moonbop, you know, with William Joyce across the hall, and a few other companies in town. It's a collection of people that have a knowledge that can filter down to the people that we have in our city. So maybe you don't have to go to New York or LA now. They can stay at home or in our state.
Yeah, I think that's important. You know, if we're going to be the next great southern city.
Yeah, we got to retain them. And what we're finding out, I mean, it's a gentleman that works in the studio, John Michael Caldwell. He's on staff here at Blade Studios, and he's from Monroe, Louisiana originally, but he moved to New York City to work at a studio, and when we opened, he came back here from New York to work here at our studio. And he's still on staff, and he's doing well. We're driving him a little crazy every now and then, but, you know, he's having fun, I think. Chris Bell came from Dallas, Texas. Young man, very talented, my friend. He's here in Shreveport, Louisiana now. So we're seeing a lot of people kind of come to our city that normally maybe wouldn't, to live and spend their money.
So you gave us some examples of some music that you've collaborated with and that you like.
Sure.
A band from England, Massive Attack. Tell me about them.
You know, Massive Attack is a band, it's a part of England called Bristol. And for a small city, it's very rich in music. Portishead comes from there. Massive Attack is originally from there. And it's a certain sound called the Bristol sound that was kind of maybe based in reggae, because they have a lot of Jamaicans that live in that city. Maybe second or third generation, but the music carries over. And they've applied this to pop and classical music. Massive Attack, from a groove perspective, is just unbelievable. They always work with different singers and artists. It's only like three guys. I think two guys left in the band. It started with four. Tricky comes out of their franchise. But when they do live shows, they put on a production that's unbelievable. and they pushed the idea and the genre of music to a better level. So they've always been just one of my favorites to listen to at home, in the car, when I'm on a plane. Yeah.
You said their sound defines a generation. What is the sound and what generation are we talking about?
Well, I guess it might be European based in a sense, because I think they're a bit more popular there than here. As far as what they've done with music and putting different ideas of music together, they were one of the first ones to kind of do that and be very successful at it, I would have to say. You know, dealing with a lot of club kind of based beats and everything else, but with a different top. So it was just quite innovative. And during the 90s and going into the year 2000, they kept pushing that envelope, and they got a lot of followers behind it. So even though they don't tour that much or anything else, their record sales and streaming and downloads are very high just because of their artistic integrity and how great the music is. Yeah, they did define a generation of people.
Clarence Greenwood with Citizen Cope. Sure. He gave us the song Sideways that you played drums on.
Yeah. A friend of mine lives in D.C. I think he lives in Brooklyn now. And we did a session at Electric Ladyland Studios in New York a few years ago. And it was myself, Michelle Indigliacello, and Clarence, who is Citizen Cope. And he's just such a great artist. He was in Freeport. A guy named Chase brought him here, I think, earlier this year. Show did really well, too. I think he did it solo. But he's always been a very innovative artist and a very great, great person. Very calm, nice. And his lyrics are fantastic, and a great songwriter. But he mixes also, once again, kind of those beats and things that normally maybe wouldn't go with folk music or singer-songwriter music, and makes it very interesting. And sometimes quite orchestral as well.
You know it ain't easy for these thoughts to leave me. There's no words to describe it. In France or in England, 'cause diamonds they fade, and flowers they bloom, and I'm telling you that these feelings won't go away. They even knocking me sideways. They even knocking me out there. Whenever you come around me, but these feelings won't go away. They've been knocking me sideways. I keep thinking in a moment that time will take them away, but these feelings won't go away. Feelings won't go away. It ain't easy for these thoughts to leave me. There's
There are no words to describe it. In France or in England, cause diamonds they fade. Flowers they know. I'm telling you, these feelings won't go away. They've been knocking me sideways. They've been knocking me out there. Whenever you come around me, these feelings won't go away. They've been knocking me sideways. I keep thinking in a moment that time will take them away. These feelings won't go away. Thinking in a moment that time will take them away. These feelings won't go away. These feelings won't go away. With diamonds they fade. Feelings won't go away.
Steve Earle.
Yeah.
political activist, songwriter.
Yes.
Artist.
Troubadour.
The best storyteller I think I've ever met. And did a record with him called El Corazon a few years ago. Russell worked on a Horse Whisperer soundtrack, Robert Redford film. He became a friend too, and once again I met him through Emmylou Harris years ago, 97, 90, you know, somewhere around there. And then I toured with him for a year, a couple of years as a Duke, Steve Earle and the Dukes. I was a Duke.
I'm just an American boy raised on MTV and seen all the kids in the soda pop bands, but none of them look like me. So I started looking around for a light out of the dim. And the first thing I heard that made sense was the word of Muhammad, peace be upon him. I shouted, "Hey, la, hey, la." God, but God, if my daddy could see me now. Chains around my feet. He don't understand that sometimes a man's got to fight for what he believes. And I believe God is great. All priests do too. I should die, I rise up to the sky just like Jesus, peace be upon him. I shall do la ila ila la. There's no God but God. Hearts were pure and strong, and death filled the air. We all offered the present prepared for our martyrdom. But Allah has some other plan, some secret not revealed. Now they're dragging me back with my head in the sack to the land of the infidel. I shall do la ilaha illallah. I shall do la ilaha illallah.
Tell you this quick story about Steve and how small the world is. He and Buddy Miller were hanging in New York, and it's a guitar shop on McDougal Street in New York. They have pretty high-end kind of acoustics and mandolins and stuff. So Buddy and Steve met in New York, and Steve's like, oh, man, you got to come in the shop. You got to hear this guitar. It's acoustic. Buddy walked in, ring, asked guy how much. Okay, I'll be right back. He had to go to the bank. So the guitar was in there on consignment, and Steve kept asking the guy, well, whose guitar is it? You know, we just want to know, you know, it was a 53 Gibson J200. Apparently beautiful, immaculate. The guy said, well, can't disclose that information, you know. And so anyway, Steve kept whittling them down. Come to find out, it was my brother's guitar, Brian.
Really?
It's like $12,000, you know, J200. Wow. that Buddy bought. And so it's kind of small. So this guitar is kind of a history of like the Red Violin or something, but it tells you how small the world is.
Well, the musical world apparently is pretty well connected. You met Dave Matthews through Emmylou Harris as well, right?
Yeah, Dave Matthews, and that was a funny story. We were playing Seattle, Pier 66, I think it is, and with Emmy doing the summer series, great. So Dave and his wife Ashley came up to the show on it. And so he sat in with us that night, and he watched the whole show, and afterwards he said, he's like, you know, one day we're going to work together. And I'm looking at him like, you know, yeah, sure, buddy. You got one of the best drummers in the world, Carter Beaufort.
Right.
I'm like, you know,
right.
Sure, you know, looking forward to it. But we went out that night and stuff and had dinner and, you know, thought that was it. And sure enough, a couple of years later, I get this email from management saying, you know, Dave's trying to get in touch with you. And I talked to him, guy called him on the phone. He's like, yeah, I'm kind of putting together some songs for a solo record and seeing if you wanted to kind of work with me on it. I'm like, sure. So they gave me the schedule a little bit because I guess he's a workaholic and his scheduling was really tight. Now, he was in Seattle. I was in Stockholm, and I had just gotten a record producing a kid named Dean Chandler for Universal in Auckland, New Zealand. And they were both at the same time when wanted me to fly out to kind of see if something was there for these songs. And then I couldn't say no to either one. So I had two guys on my production team from Sweden that was working with Dean Chandler because he didn't have a band. So it was taking my guys down. I sent them ahead to Auckland. I'm like, okay, you guys go to Auckland. I went to Seattle to meet Dave and Steve Harris, great producer from England, and we kind of started working with some of Dave's demos for about a week. Man, everything went great. It's like, okay, can we, you know, let's meet up again in a couple of weeks. I'm just like, okay. So I flew from Seattle to Auckland, went down and got the record pretty much tracked in 2 weeks, went back to Seattle, worked with Dave some more, about 4 days at a time. Went back to Auckland and finished that record, mixed it, and then went back to Stockholm. Now, in this time, Dave's like, oh, all the demos are great. We got everything. Now let's go nail it out. Went back to Seattle.
Wow.
I brought in Tony Hall and the Dirty Dozen Brass Band from New Orleans and stuff, and he brought in Trey from Fish and his old collaborator, Tim Reynolds, and then we actually made the record. And Some Devil actually gave him his first Grammy. We did a tour that following year that did really well for him. So, and he has a visit into Shreveport at some point this year, so I'm looking forward to that.
The song Save Me, you sent me the track on that.
Sure.
Really interesting song. It's not a song that you hear played a lot from Dave Matthews.
Mm-mm.
Some really interesting background voices in that.
Mm-hmm. Some gospel.
Some gospel as well. It's got a very southern feel to it.
Very southern feel to it.
Driving through the desert, I met the man who told me of his crazy plan. He'd been walking there for 20 days. He was gonna walk on for 20 more. Said, how about a drink or a bite to eat? He said, you know my faith is all I need. I said, then save me, Mr. Walking Man, if you can. You don't need to prove a thing to me. Just give me faith, make me believe. Come on, save me, Mr. Walking Man, if you can. Come on, save me, just stranger, if you please. Save me, stranger, if you please. Or am I too gone? I see to get back on, to get back on. How about you take a ride with me? We could kill some time, shoot the breeze. It's a heavy whispering wind and second counts. Oh, maybe if you walk, but you should drive around. Save me, save me, walking man, if you can. Come on, save me, stranger, if you please. Save me, stranger, if you please. Or am I too far gone to get back home? To get back home.
You told me the story about Dave in an airport once. Was he meeting you maybe in Seattle or?
Yeah. I was just flying up to see. He had his son. He's got three kids, and he had just had son August at the time. So I was just flying up to hang with the family, see him, see the new baby. So I land at Seattle Airport, and I'm coming out, with my little carry-on, and he was standing there in baggage claim, and he dresses, he's not Mr. Fancy Guy, drives a Subaru, lives in a little two-bedroom, very unassuming considering his financial status. So he had on like kind of this brown jacket and brown pants. And fair enough, he did look like he worked at the airport.
Yeah, so, or for UPS.
So the people, UPS, exactly. So the people were waiting around the carousel, they were recognizing him and stuff. But this little old lady walked between us and said, and pulled on his coat, "Young man, can you help me take my bags out?" Because she thought he was a baggage handler.
Right.
And he's like, yes, ma'am. And she pointed out two bags, and he picked up the bags, and then he carried them out, you know. Before they hit out the door, the lady hands him 50 cents, and he said, thank you, ma'am. And she... He's that kind of guy. So he walks her to the curb. She gets in a taxi and leaves. And, you know, everybody's
and
like,
never knows.
Yeah, and she never had, didn't have a clue. And, but he's that kind of guy, you know, that's really down to earth and just a sweetheart.
One thing that sort of came to mind, you were living in Sweden for a while.
Sure.
And, you know, we hear a lot about the quality of life in Scandinavia and how they're the happiest people on earth. Maybe as a civilization, you know, the happiest people that ever lived. What was your experience there?
Well, my experience, I mean, obviously the population of, what, 200 and some odd million people we have in this country, and they have 9 million people. Therefore, they can offer certain things like free health care. You know, it's just part of your regular tax payment to the government.
Right.
They don't subsidize any wars or anything. Actually, no war has ever been there, so the architecture's still in place. Environmentally speaking, they are very responsible people. I saw the power of the health system when my daughters were born. You know, I think it cost me $20 for the prenatal and post and having a baby. $20. I was like, you got to be joking. You kidding me? It's like, you know, I thought it was a catch or something. The quality of life, once a woman does have a child, usually, you know, they have to go back to work in this country. My father owns a daycare facility, so I'll see 4 weeks and 5 week babies in the daycare facility.
Really?
Sweden, so that the mother can spend ample time, if they're employed by a company and not self-employed, they can take up to a year and a half off and receive 80% of their salary. And then they have something called papa pay. So the dad can get up to 6 months. And now you're not getting rich off of this. It's just to cover your basic expenses.
Right.
The idea is so the family unit can spend time with the children, because that's a developmental time that's crucial to the growth and nourishment of a child. So therefore, you find a high percentage of mothers breastfeeding. You'll see from a point of view of these kids, you know, maybe being a bit healthier because of the breastfeeding situation. And, you know, so I'm looking at comparing my country of America to Sweden. Love both places, but I definitely see some great things where the Swedes have done well. But mind you, they've been in existence a lot longer than America has, so they've learned about mistakes or whatever
Absolutely.
The case may be. And they're not arrogant people. They're very calm. It's hard to make a friend there, but when you do make that friend, you can count on that friend for life. Just a beautiful country. And I love it.
Are you planning on visiting frequently?
Well, we still own our home there, which is rented out. But my wife's company, which is basically a pattern company, she's based in here in America, but she works a lot in Europe. So we'll spend summers there in an apartment and stuff. And the kids have an opportunity with dual citizenship to, you know, once they get 18, they can make their choice. They want to stay here in this country or go back to Europe for college or whatever. So that'll be their decision, but we're kind of maintaining the stuff there. So if they do decide to go back, they have a place to go back to.
I understand growing up in Shreveport, the son of a Baptist minister, you had the opportunity to have a lot of experiences with our diversified culture here and work with some underprivileged youth as well.
Yeah.
Can you speak about that a little bit?
Sure. I guess, you know, growing up and being born in 65, and the civil rights movement was very high at that particular time.
Right.
So my father's a part of the Red Mass, which I'm sure you're familiar with, interdenominational group of clergy and people that work in law, judges and attorneys and things like that. I'm glad he's involved in that. But my father, being a pastor for 50 years at the same church, yeah, I did grow up in that. And he started an alternative school, had an idea to start an alternative school. So a guy named Buck McGee spearheaded a grant that I assisted with, where we wanted to work with kids. The demographic was between 12 and 17 years of age. Now, if that 13-year-old got caught for selling drugs on a corner and had to go to juvenile detention or jail for juveniles, basically, educationally speaking, it's not going to work out well because they're just pretty much in jail. So if he's there for a year and a half, 2 years, comes out when he's 15, he's going to be on a fifth grade reading level or whatever. So we were trying to address that need by starting an alternative school with psychiatrists and teachers, and you know, having a very great teacher-student ratio. So kind of worked that out with Buck, and everything worked good. At this point, I was living in New Orleans, and before I was touring with Emmylou Harris. We set this up, and after the grant got approved, which my father informs me that, great, we got the grant, now you got to run it. I looked at him like, I'm living, he's like, you can make it work out. Okay, yes, sir, will do. So I was an assistant executive director for this day treatment program. What I found was the kids were great. We had a lot of problems with the parents. It was all about the home training. And I got so attached to these kids. And now we lost a lot of kids. But we got some kids in college that society said these kids weren't going to make it. They had written them off. But, you know, we lost a couple to violence, to death. This one girl, Sylvia, that still haunts me to this day, how violently she died. 15-year-old girl that was sweet. With just, you know, with the wrong people, wrong situations. And, you know, we get, as a society, we kind of get very egotistical and tied up in our own world, and you don't really kind of extend yourself to. But I was immersed into these kids' world because, you know, I had to be engaged with them, and they were just bright, just great kids. We don't have enough of these programs. And we're looking at all these problems today with youth, and once again, it's still falling back to the home where, you know, it's tough. It all starts in the home. So, but we don't have enough services if the home element's not there. Rutherford House is doing a great job. I try to go down and see my friends down at the Shreveport-Bossier Rescue Mission because they have a lot of, you know, mothers and kids that are there. You know, just I don't do enough. We've been busy with this company, and I haven't done enough with that element as of late. But I have contributed before, and I'm going to get more active again. It's a need. We've got a couple of programs that we're trying to start here, though, with Inner City Kids and with the symphony. I've spoken with Michael Butterman. So we're going to have a hip-hop producer team up with maybe a chamber orchestra right here in the studio so kids can actually see, Inner City Kids can see an oboe or a violin or a viola being played live over this and how it comes together. So it's something small, but hopefully the idea for that particular job, and we're targeting junior high kids exclusively, so they'll be able to either become a technician or they can be creative and try to do things. But we're at least going to try to start that program off sooner than later. And we've got a couple of people interested trying to earmark some money for it to get it going. But I'm hoping to get that up and running by spring before school lets out. So next fall 2012, it'll be in full effect.
You know, it was really cool to hear you talk about the Shreveport sound.
Oh, yeah.
And the ratchet movement. And I think you gave us one of those tracks maybe to listen to a little bit of that.
Sure.
How would you describe the Shreveport sound? What's ratchet music, and what do you think the future of that's going to be?
Well, it's three things that I want to mention about the Shreveport sound. And to speak about the ratchet sound, that my friend Eric Frantham is a mixologist for a lot of guys. And that song, Abebe, by Hurricane Chris, really defined a situation of hip-hop that originates from Shreveport, Louisiana. It's a certain sound that comes out of here that people love and are attached to.
It's really catchy.
Oh, it's catchy. It's hooky.
It's got a hip-hop feel. It's got a little bit of a reggae feel. It's rhythmically unique.
Exactly, and it's got its own footprint in it right from here in Shreveport, Louisiana. And then it's got clean content as well as far as lyrical content goes. So, you know, because people in hip-hop, or people that like hip-hop, sometimes it's got certain words that aren't really radio-friendly. But they've got a lot of good versions of songs that are clean that can make it. And I think some of them can even send a positive message out to some kids.
Hey, baby. Hey, baby. Hey, baby. Hey, baby. Hey, baby.
Funk Dog Exclusive.
Hey, baby. Hey, baby. Hey, baby. Hey, baby. Hey, baby. Hey, baby. Wanna know what we say in the club? Hey, baby. White folks, gangsters, and the thugs. Hey, baby. Stunting with a stack of them dubs. Hey, baby. Riding in the lap with a mug. Hey, baby. I'm in the club hollering. Hey, baby. Hey, baby. Hey, baby. Hey, baby. Hey, baby. I'm in the club hollering. Hey, baby. Hey, baby. Hey, baby. Hey, baby. Hey, baby. I'm in the club hollering. Now when I holler, hey, baby.
The next sound you have is you got these kids, the Lackadaisies, Dylan LeBlanc. That whole crew of guys that are coming from Shreveport that's based in like kind of early 70s rock and really good songwriting. That's another thing that's about to break out of the city, I believe. Dylan's already touring internationally. Is about to get revived, which is a big part of our culture, big part of our history.
Absolutely.
And now they have some efforts going on with some stuff that could really be nice for our bicentennial year next year. So I'm excited to see how that develops.
You know, well, speaking of radio, we've got a really good public radio station here in Shreveport.
It's the best ever.
And we're blessed.
Yes.
We really are. So everybody needs to support public radio.
Without a doubt.
Absolutely.
Yes.
Brady Blade, it's been a real pleasure talking to you.
Randy Brewer, it's an honor.
All right, take care.
Thank you.
As you watch the evening news.
You've been listening to a profile of Brady Blade, hosted by Randy Brewer and produced in the studios of Red River Radio. The interview session was recorded at Blade Studios in Shreveport, Louisiana, and was engineered by Chris Bell with assistance from John Michael Caldwell. We want to thank Brady Blade and everyone at Blade Studios for their invaluable assistance in the making of this program. The post-production editor and mix engineer for this program was Bill Beckett, and this has been a production of Red River Radio, a community-supported public broadcasting service of LSUS.